From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, the intersection between homelessness and AIDS is the focus of a new study by two Milwaukee researchers. Then, 13 years after 9/11, some thoughts on the slow erosion of our privacy.
It's kind of like watching grass grow or paint dry. Because it's happening slowly, many people don't even realize it's happening. Or at least for the younger generation, because they never realized they had it, they don't realize they have anything to lose.
We get fall gardening tips from contributor Melinda Myers and singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves on the merits of writing story songs.
I actually think it's a little bit easier just because if you already have the story, then you don't have to make up very much. You already have kind of the framework to work with. You just got to figure out how to make it rhyme.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Many successful programs to help HIV patients, such as the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, rely on a so-called medical home model, in which a variety of services, say from medical care to pharmacy to mental health support, are provided under one roof. But reaching and helping people with HIV and AIDS can be especially challenging when we're talking about the homeless population. In recent years, a variety of supporting housing programs have evolved in an effort to help homeless people live longer, healthier lives with HIV. But little is known about how well those programs work. Two Milwaukee researchers are hoping to find the answers. Julia Dixon Gomez and Steven Pinkerton are scientists with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research and recipients of a multi-million-dollar federal grant to study housing, homelessness, and AIDS. The two joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio last month, and Dixon Gomez explained what we already know about the link between homelessness and AIDS.
One thing we know is that the homeless are about 16 times more likely to become infected with HIV than people who are not homeless. We also know that among people who are already infected with HIV, about half of them have reported housing needs. We know that those who are homeless have a harder time getting access and linked into medical care. They have a poorer adherence to antiretroviral medicines, which help them live longer.
And is part of that because of their housing situation?
Most definitely. I mean, it's hard to keep track of pills when you're moving from place to place, it's harder. Just the general life is a little bit chaotic. Also, I think sometimes there's still stigma and a lot of people want to hide taking medication. That's harder to do if you're in a shelter or if you're kind of temporarily doubling up with another drug-using acquaintance, for example.
And you mentioned drug use, and the homeless population isn't just impacted with HIV, but there are other issues that are wrapped up with this too, right?
Yeah. I mean, the study that was just funded, which is actually my third study on housing / homelessness and HIV, this is a project that's going to be looking at supportive housing programs, which are designed for a particular segment of the homeless population, what is generally considered the chronically homeless. In order to be eligible for the subsidies for supportive housing programs, generally people receive shelter plus care subsidies, which means you have one of three qualifying conditions. So you're HIV positive, you have substance use disorder or severe mental illness. Oftentimes they have a couple or all three. The chronically homeless is actually defined as people who have been homeless for a period longer than a year or for people who've had multiple periods of homelessness in the last 3 years. So these are kind of, for want of a better word, kind of the more severe end of the spectrum of homelessness.
And maybe this is an obvious question, but what are the challenges in studying these issues and this population? This is not always an easy population to quantify, right?
not so much if they're housed, and that's hopefully going to be the case in this study. In the previous two studies, we were actually looking at people in a variety of housing situations, but all low income. And yes, the homeless are hard to track. They have often transient work, so they'll be gone for a season. They often end up in jail, unfortunately, or the hospital. So we don't have – we have pretty good retention rates. But the previous studies were in Hartford, Connecticut as well, which is a small city. So we knew where to look for them, and if we couldn't find them, we generally figured they weren't there and that they would eventually show up. So sometimes we had longitudinal studies where we would track them at 6 and 12 months. Sometimes when we couldn't find them at 6 months, we could at 12. So,
Stephen Pinkerton, why is this work the purview of psychiatry and behavioral medicine?
Well, I think the link there are two pieces to it that go together. One is related to the fact that HIV does have effects on the brain. So very early on, that was one link between the study of HIV and mental health, in particular the National Institute of Mental Health at NIH began to fund these studies. The other obvious link is that HIV is behaviorally transmitted. And even now, as we have more effective treatments, behavior plays an important role in making sure people actually take those treatments, attend their medical appointments, et cetera. So HIV is very much a behavioral disease that also has important neurological impacts.
What are the different kinds of housing models that you're studying? Because that's I guess, the key question you're asking in this latest work is the effectiveness of these various models. What are the types of models that exist?
Most of this comes under the umbrella of supportive housing. And a lot of it was modeled from a program in New York called Pathways to Housing. Now, this was a different kind of model. This kind of model they call housing first. So the idea is that whatever their problems are in terms of mental illness or substance use, it's important first to get them housed before they can try to address these other issues. Prior to that, they had kind of continuum of care models where people had to go through drug treatment or mental health treatment, maybe spend some time in halfway houses and go through all these hoops before they were eligible for permanent housing. So supportive housing is permanent supportive housing. And so the Pathways model was definitely a harm reduction approach. Come as you are. You have the right to accept any kind of services. These programs are usually linked with services, at a minimum, case management to help with daily living.
And these are typically under the same roof?
No, not necessarily. They have both project-based and scattered sites. So project-based is under one roof. Scattered site, you get a housing voucher, much like a housing choice voucher, which used to be known as Section 8. And you get to choose your own apartment. So it's kind of the idea like free market rental housing, except that people in the agency often intervene and have close relationships with landlords to make it easier for people to rent because they don't have the best credit histories. They often have incarceration histories. So, I mean, that's one of the differences in the models. I think originally the Pathways to Housing model was very much consumer choice. So the idea was that people would get vouchers and have a choice in where to live. In practice, it doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes it's an active choice. You know, it's much easier to provide services under one roof. All the services that residents might need. On the other hand, you know, they lose a sense of autonomy and choice. On the other hand, in practice, sometimes because demand's so outmatches or the need so outmatches the actual supply of supportive housing. In reality, people may not have that much choice at all. I think what may happen in practice is that people are on a waiting list and then they take what they can get, which may or may not be the best match. And of course, there are all sorts of other issues that probably play into the decision about where and what kind of housing to provide. There are, you know, the reactions from neighbors. There are funding constraints. And so I think this is the first study, to my knowledge, where we can really look at a place that has a significant number of supportive housing units because Chicago and Illinois in general, but particularly Chicago, has been one of the forerunners in the supportive housing movement. And take a look at how all these different factors affect the kinds of housing that are provided.
Does that mean that the current approach to housing as a factor in preventing and treating HIV has largely been guided through theory or hunches to this point?
More or less. I mean, there have been there has been studies that have shown a definite link between improvements in housing status and improvements in health and decreases in emergency room visits for those who are living with HIV and decreases in sexual and drug injection risks for those who are not yet positive. But Chicago was actually one of the first sites where they did a randomized control trial. They had people who were homeless and they randomized them to immediate supportive housing or waitlist control. And in their intent to treat analysis, you know, just comparing those in the two conditions, regardless of what their housing status became, they found some not significant findings, but definite trends. But what had happened actually is that half of the people in the waitlist control achieved housing because they were getting all sorts of caseworker help in obtaining housing. So when you look at actually the people who were not getting housing and those who were and did that comparison, there were definite significant differences in terms of health outcomes and risk behavior. And I think we're pretty convinced that, yes, housing works. The question, though, is which model of housing works the best and for what kind of resident and how much do they cost, which is where Steve comes in.
We're interested not only in the benefits that can be achieved, but at what cost. Obviously, these programs are not free. However, in addition to providing housing to people who otherwise would be unstably housed, they also have a lot of societal benefits. Julia already mentioned the fact that we'd expect to see fewer hospitalizations, fewer emergency room visits, hopefully less incarceration. There are a number of societal benefits that we'd like to capture the cost of to see, in fact, whether these programs pay for themselves. And maybe more importantly and more in line with the rest of the project, we'd like to look at what factors drive that. Is it a particular model of supportive housing? Is it whether or not things are clustered versus scattered site? What are those factors that affect the cost? And overall, is the cost beneficial? Does it actually pay for itself? Is it cost saving?
And presumably, this is the kind of data that housing agencies or public health units of government or policymakers can take when they're actually trying to shape what housing for this population should look like in a particular community.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, this National AIDS Housing Coalition and the research summit that they do, they have been very interested in cost-benefit analyses and cost-effectiveness. And there have been a number of studies that have done that have shown that, yes, housing is cost-effective. But this question of which model is, again, kind of up in the air.
Well, but presumably maybe at the end of this five-year period, a little less up in the air.
We hope to tease it apart, but
we
it is very complicated. You've got personal, individual factors. You've got factors at the housing level. There are a number of variables to take into account.
We'll learn. I'm confident we'll learn some things.
Yes.
Well, hopefully in the years down the road, we can have you back and talk about what you're learning.
Sure. Be my pleasure.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton, thank you so much to both of you, and best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton are professors of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. They're also researchers with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research. They're recipients of a five-year, $3.1 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study housing models for homeless people with AIDS. They first spoke with Mitch Tyke last month. Coming up next, on the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a professor of criminal justice wonders about the long-range implications of the security measures that we've adopted to protect ourselves. We'll hear more when Lake Effect returns right after this. Lake Effect returns on WUWM Now. I'm Bonnie North. Today is the 13th anniversary of the terrorist attacks that brought down planes and buildings in New York, Washington, D.C., and in Pennsylvania. In the time since then, laws have been passed, measures have been taken, and technology has been developed in the name of improving our national security. Lake Effect essayist Stephen Brandle wonders about the other effects of those laws and that technology.
The other day, I got an email from the National Institute of Justice, the arm of the United States Department of Justice, that funds much of the research that's conducted on crime and justice issues. The title of the email was, "Purchasing Through-the-Wall Sensors? Read a New Report." Even though I'm not in the market for a through-the-wall sensor, I read the report anyway. In a nutshell, it discussed the value and effectiveness of various devices that can essentially, well, see through walls. Indeed, such devices could come in handy for law enforcement when buildings are on fire or collapse or during tactical or hostage situations. But this got me thinking, might this technology or a more advanced variant of it be used for other applications as well? Wouldn't this sort of technology also be useful for the police as they drove down the streets to see or hear what's going on inside of houses? Wouldn't this be great? Fights and arguments could be interrupted before they turn into homicides. There's only one problem. Do you want the police to have the ability to see what you're doing inside of your house? A couple hundred years ago, we came to the conclusion that individual privacy is precious and is to be protected. Privacy was seen as a basic right of citizens. The Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution said so. When the Fourth Amendment was first crafted, searches of citizens could only be conducted by authorities when they had good reason or probable cause to suspect involvement in criminal activity and when they had a warrant. But over time, the Fourth Amendment has been redefined and reinterpreted. Now the overwhelming amount of searches that are conducted by the police are without probable cause or a warrant, and these searches are perfectly legal. Some people would argue that the Fourth Amendment is but a shell of what it used to be. Generally speaking, the police can conduct searches without a warrant or probable cause in emergencies, of vehicles and certain other places, in stop-and-frisk situations, when citizens consent to searches, as well as in several other situations. With the passage of the USA Patriot Act in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, governmental authority to conduct searches expanded again, as we were reminded with the revelations of Mr. Edward Snowden last year. It is fair to say our privacy continues to slowly disappear. As I explained to my students in my criminal investigation class at UW-Milwaukee, it's kind of like watching grass grow or paint dry. Because it's happening slowly, many people don't even realize it's happening. Or at least for the younger generation, because they never realized they had it, they don't realize they have anything to lose. At the very least, some of the loss of privacy we enthusiastically accept. For example, if you've used Google Maps, satellite or street view, if you've talked on your cell phone in public to have a private conversation, or used certain features on Facebook or other social media sites, then you know what I'm talking about. Each of these things whittles away our privacy. By the way, some listeners might remember before there were cell phones, there were public payphones. And often those phones were located in booths, where you would step inside and shut the door to keep your conversation private. Not anymore. The technology available to law enforcement continues to challenge what the courts call reasonable expectation of privacy. For example, the law prohibits the police from conducting strip and body cavity searches on the street, but when I went to the airport last week, I and everyone else who passed through security underwent a perfectly legal electronic strip search. That same logic could be applied to other technologies as well. Some are under development, some are already available, such as through-the-wall sensors. Or how about cameras that are located everywhere? Or cameras that can see through clothing? What about tiny drones outfitted with cameras that can follow people or look through windows? Or devices that can detect brain activity as an indicator of deception? Or technology that can quickly search billions of email messages for specific senders, recipients, and keywords? Law enforcement technology that effectively tracks the location of cell phones is continuing to advance. DNA is being collected and stored from more and more people. Work is being done in various places to create massive databases of personal information for law enforcement purposes. All of this is being done for the benefit of crime detection and criminal apprehension. Is this what we want? Well, it depends on your perspective. At the very least, it is important to realize three things. First, technology is not inherently all good. We should realize that for as much good that technology produces, there is also bad. In this light, technology is a double-edged sword. Second, and more specifically, we must realize that the development and use of technology for law enforcement purposes has costs and benefits. Some costs are financial. It costs money, taxes, to develop and deploy technology. If we think technology is great, then we have to be willing to pay for it. Other costs are in the form of less privacy and fewer individual freedoms. Finally, we must realize that less privacy doesn't necessarily mean less crime or more effective criminal apprehension. The deployment of some of these technologies may impact the ability of the police to prevent and detect certain crimes, but not always. The bottom line here is this: technology and laws are slowly eroding our privacy. That might be okay for most of us if there are crime control benefits that follow, but that is not necessarily the case. What we are left with then is just less privacy.
Lake Effect essayist Steve Brandl is a professor of criminal justice at UW-Milwaukee's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Whether you're still planting or starting over for next year, contributor Melinda Myers has some suggestions for what you should do in your garden this fall. We'll find out more from her when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. As you listen to us this morning, the weather has made a statement. The summer's behind us. Just a day after the temperature neared 80 in downtown Milwaukee, the forecast calls for highs in the 50s over the next couple of days, with lows reaching into the low 40s. And while we'll probably still see some warmer conditions in the days to come, it's a good reminder that gardening and yard work are transitioning as well. Melinda Myers is an author, garden expert, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. She spoke with Mitch Tyke about the opportunity that fall affords us in the yard.
Oh, fall's a great time to plant. You know, with the rainy season we had, you know, I don't know about you, but a lot of gardeners, including myself, if you were off, chances are it was raining that day. And so you may not have gotten all the chores done or all the planting done, or maybe some plants didn't make it through the winter, but you never got them replaced. Well, fall is great. The soil's warm. The air is cool. It's a great time to get perennials, trees, and shrubs in the ground. And you can also pop in some annuals like pansies that will make it through the winter, the hardy pansies like Cool Wave and Icicle, and be back in spring and flowering for you. So it's really not a time just of closing down for the year, but really getting things ready for winter, but preparing for next year as well.
So the stuff that we're putting into the ground, by and large, is not necessarily for this year, but really for the year coming up.
You bet. You know, we all buy mums and asters, myself included. They're in bloom. They're beautiful. But all their energy is going into the flowers. So they may or may not make it through the winter. Leave them stand. After the ground freezes, throw some evergreen boughs on top. That'll increase your chance of success. And my theory is if they make it, you're a great gardener. If they die, you planned it that way. You were just using them as an annual to fill a void or in a pot on your front steps. That added color just brings a lot of joy to the landscape and kind of the last hurrah of the season.
Now, my copy of Month by Month Gardening in Minnesota and Wisconsin makes the point that you can still plant edibles this year.
You bet. And in fact, I was doing that in my garden yesterday, trying to beat the rain and trying to make sure I could get a few last things. And greens are excellent. They're done in 45 days. Now, granted, we may have a killing frost in early October. You never know. But I always keep a good supply of floating row covers. They're fabric that let air, light, and water through, but they retain the heat and can protect your plants down to 24 degrees. And I've been able to keep my crops going, and I know a few gardeners that harvest greens on Thanksgiving with the help of the floating row covers.
So what kinds of greens would you recommend?
You know, I planted some spinach, some lettuce. There's a trout lettuce that is Renee's Garden, a wonderful, great fun, different kind of seeds, a lot of heirlooms. Red sales lettuce, which is available at garden centers readily. Musclin, arugula, a lot of mixes out there. So all those things that are done in 45 days. I planted radishes yesterday. My carrots, I'm pushing my luck. And my peas, I'm going to have to get a tall tarp to cover of Remay to cover those. But, you know, those are all plants that take it cool. And so they'll take those cooler temperatures. The flavor is even better. If you eat lettuce in the summer, sometimes it can be a little bitter. But those cool temperatures, the seeds germinate fast in that warm soil, the cool air, the better flavor you'll have.
What about fall as the time to start to right things that went wrong?
You know, it is a great time. One is if you don't have a map or diagram of your garden, kind of sketch something out, identify those voids. Maybe you want to pop some bulbs in there. Maybe you've got a plant that's struggling. You know, the winter was hard on a lot of evergreens, and gardeners tend to be optimistic. And I know a lot of people left some really struggling plants in the yard. If it hasn't shown signs of recovery, it might be time to say out of the garden and replace it with something, maybe a plant you've always wanted but didn't have room. And again, a lot of things are on sale, and so it's a good time to get your money's worth. Often it's drier in the fall. I don't know about this year, but often it's drier in the fall so we can work the soil, prepare the garden, and get our new plants in. Again, the warm soil, the cool air, plants get established. And then come spring, you have more time to do some maintenance, clean up, and maybe add some annuals and brighten things up. So you've got a good head start for next year.
If I remember correctly, fall is also a good time to start the rehab process for lawns.
You bet. Again, grass does great when planted, grass seed this time of year, or sod. You know, again, warm soil, cool air, your seed will germinate quickly. Also a good time to fertilize. If you didn't fertilize around Labor Day, still time to get that fertilization down. The last time you're going to fertilize is late October through to Thanksgiving, one of those time. The lawn is not only putting on top growth much slower than in the spring, but putting down roots and spreading. So the good news is your fertilizer is helping to grow and increase the density of your lawn versus making it grow tall faster, so you have to mow more, which this summer we've all gotten to mow our lawns quite a bit with the rain and the cool.
I was going
to
say the best news this time of year is the reduction in mowing frequency.
You bet. Exactly. So it's good to see the grass blades come up and fill in those empty spots, speed things along by just, you know, a handful of grass seed and a bucket of topsoil, mix it up, sprinkle it in those bare spots. If your lawn's more than 60% weeds, this might be the time to think about killing everything off, preparing the soil, and either seeding or sodding this fall. Best time, you'll get great results. And again, your lawn will be in shape to get started next year. So the goal will be keeping it going next year versus starting in the spring rain and before the heat of summer arrives.
Well, let me ask you a question. How would you go about killing everything off?
You know, if you don't mind using chemicals, Roundup or something like that, a total vegetation killer. And if you have time, you want to hit it once, wait. If it starts to repop, you'll hit it a second time 2 weeks later. We're kind of getting to the end of the grass seeding, so you might want to do it once. And the benefit of doing that is it kills not only the top, but the roots. And so if you can get the soil prepared, adding organic matter, killing off the weeds, your lawn's going to get off to a good start. So in a year, you don't have a new lawn full of half weeds and half grass, but rather mostly grass. And then you can spot treat as needed so that you're getting it off to a good start, reducing your work in the long run. So investing up front, and I know it's a lot of work, and you look at that dead lawn going, ugh, what was I thinking? But it's a good payoff in the long run. And maybe do sections. Maybe go, okay, the back is really bad. The kids like to play there. School's back in session. Maybe we'll take care of that now. And then maybe spring is the front lawn and we'll sod it because we want quick results because that's our public space. So you might want to divide your yard up or pick the worst and go to the parts that are a little bit better. And fertilizing and leaving your clippings on the lawn have proven to help reduce weeds by as much as 50%. Those two simple things.
How long do you need to wait between the point at which you kill everything off and the point that you add the organic matter to it?
Good question. You want to check the label, and it'll tell you, depending on the carrier and depending on the product, anywhere from 4 to 14 days.
So before we wrap up, a quick mention that you will be going somewhere soon that there are no hard frosts. What are you doing in Costa Rica?
We're doing a nice garden birdwatching tour with Earthbound Expeditions, and you can check out my website. The weather will be warm. They'll have local guides to help us with the flora, the fauna. We'll take morning and evening bird walks. We can zip line through the rainforest, and you don't have to do that if you're afraid of heights, but it'll be a wonderful opportunity to see really a horticultural paradise. This has been on my bucket list, and I'm really excited to be sharing it with other gardeners. I've done about 4 other garden tours in the past, and the cool part is gardeners are good people. You know, we've never had a clinker in the group. So if you're like, ooh, do I want to do a group tour? No, gardeners take their optimistic spirit with them on travel. We've always had a good time, and it's really a blast. And just think, in November, might be a nice way to start the winter off with a little warm retreat.
And by then, the leaves will all have fallen.
So. Exactly. And you'll rake them up, compost them, and be ready to go.
little reward for doing that. Melinda Myers, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening. Her most recent titles include Minnesota and Wisconsin, Month by Month Gardening, and Minnesota and Wisconsin, Getting Started Gardening Guide. Myers is our regular Lake Effect gardening contributor, and she spoke with Mitch Tyke. You can find a link to all things Melinda, plus information about her Costa Rican gardening trip at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves chats with Mitch Tyke and plays a few tunes in the studio. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio, coming up next.
You wonder why you went. You don't wonder what you stayed on for. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
Go off to... It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. For a singer-songwriter, Slade Cleaves isn't the most loquacious guy you'll ever meet. The About section of his website says, Slade Cleaves grew up in Maine, lives in Texas, writes songs, tries to be good. It turns out that all the really important stuff is in his songs. Cleaves writes about love and loss and longing, but he doesn't shy away from difficult topical subjects either, as this song, Still Fighting the War, the title track off his newest album, proves. Cleaves tells the story of one of the many Americans who've returned from tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan since the War on Terror began. This summer, Cleaves, along with guitarist Scrappy Judd Newcomb, stopped by the Lake Effect studio to play some tunes and to chat with Mitch Tyke.
How many heroes are scattered out into the wind? And all the happily ever afters turn to broken dishes and slamming doors. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
Slade Cleaves with Scrappy Judd Newcomb, Still Fighting the War. What a beautiful, heartbreaking song. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
And welcome to Milwaukee.
Hey, thanks so much. It's been a couple of years.
Yeah, it's been a while. It must have been something to have written that song, especially with its references to the VA, and have all of this controversy about the VA suddenly come to the fore. I mean, you have tapped into something that is on a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, I felt that happening as I was going through the various versions of the song. It developed over a period of a few years when the VA issue would kind of come and go and come and go, and then it came to the fore in the media big time just as the record was about to be released. So we thought we'd tie in with some veterans organizations with the album release, and that was really great to get to know some of those people and to funnel some donations their way. And It felt good.
Have you had a chance to perform the song much for veterans?
Not for any veterans groups per se yet, but I have had veterans show up at shows. And, of course, it's really powerful when they shake my hand and tell me where they were and how much the song meant to them. It's funny, when the song came out and I was making this connection and I thought, hey, I have a song that has some relevance to the local news, then I realized I read a statistic that veterans' families make up 1% of the population. So it kind of makes sense that I play for about 100 people a night and there's usually one veteran. So it's not like I tapped into this huge zeitgeist or anything. It's a tiny portion of the country, which was really shocking to me. But making that connection is incredibly powerful.
Well, and it struck me as I listened to this whole album that a lot of the people that you are writing about and singing about are people who feel like they've kind of been passed by.
Well, I think that goes to the Woody Guthrie edict that a folk singer's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I'm always on the lookout for underdogs who need their story told.
Well, and, you know, I've heard the same thing said about journalists, and I don't know that I ever connected what the folk singer does with what a journalist does until maybe just this very moment, but there's some overlap there.
Historically, especially, yeah. If you think about the development of journalism and the development of folk music in the earlier part of the century, yeah, they kind of did go hand in hand, exposing the evils of the world.
Speaking truth to power. And,
yeah, there you go.
So do you feel like in some small way you are working to keep some of these people from being passed by?
Oh, definitely. I do take that. So I take that sort of folk music part of what I do, that tradition, very seriously. Yeah.
Well, and getting back to Still Fighting the War, was it one veteran story that sparked this song in you or really reading about the issue as a whole?
I think it started reading about the issue as a whole. A particular veteran contributed to the title, actually. A buddy of mine, Ron Coy, was good friends with a Vietnam War vet who never readjusted to society completely. He passed away when I was writing this song, still battling the VA over his Agent Orange exposure. And my buddy talked about his friend Brian. My buddy Ron said, you know, it was like Brian, the whole time he was home, it was like he was still fighting the war. And so Ron provided the title of the song, talking about his friend Brian. So, yeah, there's a direct connection there. Some of the other imagery from the song came after I saw this Pulitzer Prize-winning photo essay in the Denver Post. Craig Walker is the photographer who followed a veteran around for Iraq War veteran around for, I think, 7 months in Denver and just produced this harrowing series of photographs of this guy trying so hard to readjust to life and to get back into the swing of things and failing and really struggling. It's just beautiful photographs.
Well, I was hoping, speaking of songs that you have written, you might grace us with another one from the new record.
Would love to, yes. I think let's do Rust Belt Fields. I wrote this with my old buddy Rod Picott from South Berwick, Maine as well.
This is my town, out in the Rust Belt fields. We were banging out Buicks and Oldsmobiles. There was always a job, and the money was there. Some say we got a little lazy, nobody seemed to care. But they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. I learned a little something about how things are. No one remembers your name just for working hard. To the ground till your factory's cold and they tear it all down and the parts get sold. Come the bankers now picking over the bones. I got three more neighbors now about to lose their home. As they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. No one remembers your name just for working hard. There's a casino boat up around Boone. Think I'll buy me a bottle in a motel room. Put all I have left on a little black square. Risk it all like the big boys, like I don't even care. I'll drive you into the crowd. Engine's cold, calling the auctioneer as the banks foreclose. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. No one remembers your name just for working hard.
Slade Cleaves with Scrappy Judd Newcomb singing Rust Belt Fields from your most recent CD, Still Fighting the War. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
That was a song that that we were listening to actually in the car the other day. I was driving, I think I was driving my daughter, she's 10, back from the ice rink. And I mentioned that I was doing this interview, and she said, well, ask him why he writes songs that make me feel so sad when he gets to the end. And I almost feel bad asking it in that way. But, you know, it's – I'll just ask that question. You know, is there something to leaving people with that feeling as the last chord is struck?
Well, there's a few answers to that. I mean, I was moved by sad songs as a young child. I mean, I remember just crying when I heard the song "Kalijah," the Hank Williams song about the wooden Indian who falls in love with the other wooden Indian across the street, and then the other wooden Indian gets taken away by somebody, and he's all alone. And so there's an ancient appeal in my bones there for the sad song. And then growing up as an adolescent, hard-hitting sad songs that sort of told my story or articulated the hard times I was going through growing up, those were very, very powerful and valuable to me.
Well, and I know your publishing company, I guess, is Magic Rat Records, and that is a character from maybe the ultimate tragic song by Bruce Springsteen.
The name of my garage band with Rod Picott in 1981 was the Magic Rats, named after the Jungle Land character.
Yeah. I'm looking at the guitar you were playing, and I can't help but ask this question. It looks like it has been part of the family for a while.
Yeah, you're right there. My dad bought it new in 1965. I was a baby. And just played it around the house, but of course I was enthralled every time he played it. And about 25 years ago, I borrowed it just because I had a Yamaha guitar that I played in a little band with a drummer, and I kept breaking strings because I would play so hard. So I asked my dad if I could borrow his guitar just to have something on the side of the stage as a replacement, and I soon realized it was a much better guitar than my cheap Yamaha, so I just kind of never give it back to him. He's got a nice Martin, so he's all set.
But that has, and I don't necessarily speak guitar, but seemingly this wonderful warm sound to it.
Yeah, it's a nice guitar, and you know, it's nothing fancy, but it's just been well worn, broken in nicely, and you know, I try to take care of it. And for a 50-year-old instrument, it's holding up pretty well. Yeah.
I would imagine that if there's any place in the world where there would be people who are good at fixing 50-year-old instruments, it would be Austin.
Yeah, there's a few down there.
Yeah, Austin kind of has everything you need in the music world, yeah.
Well, you, of course, grew up in Maine and now call Austin home. But I guess you still have strong ties to Maine. Do you see similarities between the places that you have called home, or as part of the appeal to each of them, how different they are?
Well, yes and yes. Karen, my wife, and I were sure ready to get out of those Maine winters for a while, so that was part of the appeal of Texas. And yeah, Texas is a much bigger cultural change than we ever anticipated, so it's been quite an adventure learning on the ways of the Texans down there. It's like moving to another country almost. But there are some similarities, Maine being kind of off on its own, kind of isolated on the edge of the country, breeds kind of an independent spirit that is common to the Texas way of life, I think, just sort of the do-it-yourself, independent, go-your-own-way kind of spirit. And also people in Maine are super proud of their state, just like people in Texas.
You have a handful of story songs, I guess is the way to put it, in your discography, and one that I'm hoping you'll play for us in a couple minutes. But my question first is a story song a more labor-intensive enterprise than a more traditional or conventional AABA sort of song?
I actually think it's a little bit easier just because if you already have the story, then you don't have to make up very much. You already have kind of the framework to work with. You just got to figure out how to make it rhyme.
Is there and the one we were talking about that I'm hoping you'll play is called Below, and I'll have you kind of give us a little bit of background on it. And I wonder if there's some appeal in portraying history that's often overlooked or forgotten in that same way that you're telling the story of people who have been perhaps overlooked or forgotten.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, of course, when I sing a song about a town, the time forgot sort of thing, you know, I'm singing about the people from that town, and those people Most people show up at my shows sometimes. So, yeah, I've always maybe growing up in Maine with rooting for the Red Sox, I've always had a thing for the underdog.
Slade Cleaves and Scrappy Judd Newcomb, thank you both so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for inviting us over, man.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. And tell us just a brief snippet of what this last song is about.
Well, I don't want to give anything away. I just say that this is a song about the town of Flagstaff, Maine, which you will not see on the map unless it's a really old map. There's an older road just off Route 9, fades into the lake at the low waterline. Sometimes I wander down that road alone.
Slade Cleaves, along with Scrappy Judd Newcomb, performing Cleaves' song Below in Lake Effect Studio C1. Cleaves was in Milwaukee last month to perform at Shank Hall, and he stopped by the studio then to speak with Mitch Tyke. And I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
The dusky waters move cold and slow, and the ghosts of the village still wander below. Homesteads, families, and friends forevermore haunting the valley.